There's a certain type of video that will often draw me in. You've probably seen them on YouTube or TikTok, young people reacting to music from before they were born. To me, it's oddly soothing to get to watch someone in real time discover songs from my youth, like Rage Against the Machine, Beastie Boys, Riot Girl, Rhythm Nation era Janet Jackson. I knew all the moves from those videos, by the way. But the reaction videos to one particular song are almost painful to watch. When the videos start, the reactors might think they're hearing just another ancient jazz standard. But then they hear the words. Some of these reactors start crying. Some sit in stunned silence after it's done. Some look at the camera lens, and you see they'll be haunted by that moment forever. And that's in 2026. Imagine crowds of people who have come to a club in 1939 to see an incredible new singer for a night of entertainment, and then they hear this song. How has one song stunned for nearly a century? How was it so powerful that the federal government targeted the singer for decades? And what can we learn from the story of Strange Fruit and Billie Holiday about how art is resistance? From Rebel Yell Creative, this is The Art of Resistance, a podcast about using writing, music, and all kinds of art to resist the status quo. I'm your host and producer, Amy Lee Lillard, and I'm an author, a podcaster, and middle-aged queer autistic weirdo who's been obsessing over artists who resisted since I was a kid. And today, I'm looking to make all the dangerous art and help others do the same. Now, before we go further, just talking about the song is not going to cut it. We have to hear it. This is the audio from a performance in 1956, nearly 20 years after Billie Holiday first performed Strange Fruit. At this point in her life, Billie is struggling in many ways for reasons we'll get to in a minute. But first, let's listen.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain together, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter cry.
The story of Strange Fruit starts in a very surprising place. In the 1930s, Abel Mirapol was a Jewish teacher from the Bronx. He and his wife were communists, a not-too-shocking fact in the 1930s. Abel saw a picture that showed two black teenagers, Thomas Shipp and Abraham Smith, hanging from a tree in Indiana. They were surrounded by a crowd of smiling, proud white people, dressed for church. These photos weren't uncommon. In fact, in some places in the South and farther north, people would sell photographs of lynchings as postcards. After seeing this photo, Abel wrote a poem and called it Strange Fruit. It was published in a magazine, and that could have been that. I don't know about you, but as a white, cisgender, Gen X woman, it took me way too fucking long to learn about lynching. And this idea and its history is just one of our historical realities that's being wiped away right now in museums, parks, and historical sites. So here's the painful truth. Long after the Civil War, long into the 1900s, longer than white America will admit, lynching was a tool to keep black people powerless and silent. Here's Paula Giddings, professor of Afro-American Studies at Smith College, in a 2015 interview.
The legal definition of lynching is when three or more persons, which constitute a mob, put someone to death extra-legally without court sanction, without legal sanction, and they do it for the purpose of tradition and or whatever their version of justice is.
It could start for any reason, or no reason. Let's use a common example. A white man feels slighted and claims he sees a black man looking too long at his girlfriend. There's no truth that will make a difference. A mob assembles, an arrest is made. And that innocent black man is tortured, mutilated, and burned, before or after being hung by a tree. No due process. The police were often involved, and the community would gather, egging on and celebrating the brutality, taking a smiling black and white picture to mark the moment. From 1882 to 1968, nearly 5,000 people were reported lynched in the U.S. That's according to the NAACP. But they and many historians say this number is probably far less than what actually happened. Here's Farah Jasmine Griffin, a professor at Columbia University, in a 2002 documentary on the song.
We see lynching emerging on the national scene as a way of policing black communities as early as 1890s, right after Reconstruction, when there's a sense that black people are making too many political and economic gains. Lynching was often used as a mean to contain and control a community that was overstepping its bounds politically and economically. But the reason given for lynching was that it was because of a rape of a white woman. Lynchings were often accompanied by the mutilation of the black body. And that's something that Americans are fascinated by and ashamed of and quite afraid of, not just for its racial implications, but for the implications around sexuality. Those are the hidden scripts behind every lynching photograph or lynching story, lynching poem.
And lest we think we're evolved now, it's not over. In 1998, James Byrd was chained to a car by three white supremacists and dragged to his death in the streets of Jasper, Texas. In 2020, Ahmed Arbery was fatally shot while jogging near Brunswick, Georgia. The three white men charged with killing him claimed he was trespassing. People will cite stand your ground laws as an excuse for attacking and killing Black and other people of color. And you could make a case that police killings of young Black men, a modern form of lynching. So back to the 1930s. A couple years after that poem was published, Billie Holiday was a 23-year-old singer with a residency at Cafe Society, a club in New York that prided itself on being inclusive and integrated at a time when that wasn't the case. Soon after publishing his poem, Abel Meeropol had turned it into a song. He'd been singing his song around the city at protest rallies and small venues. And eventually, the song came to Billie's attention with the request that she sing and record it. And Billie hesitated, for good reason. More than anything, she was afraid of being targeted. A Black woman singing about racism, about murder, the sins of white America. Up to then, Billie had been walking a very narrow path. She'd grown up poor in Baltimore, and she was only 14 and desperate for work when she first auditioned as a singer. Billie gained fame for her unique voice and take on jazz standards. Here she is in 1948 with an interviewer.
Oh, I've got a question I've been burning to ask, and I almost forgot about it. You have a most unusual style. Everybody says that. How did you develop it? Did it just come out of the thin blue?
Well, I always wanted to sing like Louis Armstrong played. I always wanted to sing like an instrument, you know, like any instrument, you know.
Up to this point, Billie was known for jazz songs, love songs, blues songs, with a bit of melancholy. But then strange fruit came her way. And when you grow up poor, Black, and woman, and then find some success, of course you're going to hesitate before you take on a song like Strange Fruit. Soon, though, Billie said yes. When Billie first performed the song at Cafe Society in 1939, it was an experience. The waiters would stop serving. The lights would go black. There'd be a single spotlight on her face. She would sing the song once without an encore, and when the lights came back up, she'd be gone. Living in today's world, we might be able to anticipate some of the reactions that happened back in 1939. Utter shock. Sadness. Hyperbolic praise, histrionic rebuke. Some people would walk out. Some people told every single person they knew to go see Billie sing Strange Fruit. Billie recorded the song on an independent label that would risk the censure. Her main label would not. Many radio stations blacklisted the song, especially in the South. But as we all know, time and again, if you ban something, you just make it more enticing. So the song eventually sold 1 million copies to become the best-selling record of her career. And that kind of success makes racists and the powers that be really pissed off. Harry Anslinger was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. He was an avowed racist who even used slurs in official memos. He warned Billie to stop performing the song. When she didn't, he assigned an undercover black officer to get close to her and document her drug abuse, which led to her arrest. In 1947, she was sentenced to a year in a West Virginia federal prison, where she was forced to go through heroin withdrawal. She was banned from performing in New York after that. Once she got out, through the 1950s, Billie continued to perform where she could. But she also slipped back into heroin use and had severe heart and lung problems and liver disease from drugs and alcohol. In 1959, Billie collapsed and was hospitalized. She was given methadone at the hospital and started to recover. But Harry Anslinger, who had never given up his hatred of Billie, arrested her in the hospital, handcuffed her to a gurney, and cut off her methadone. She died a few days later. In 1999, Time magazine named Strange Fruit the song of the century. By that point, history showed how the song had helped galvanize a movement. Not long after the song came out, an anti-lynching campaign used the song to try to convince congressmen to vote for that anti-lynching bill. Here's Professor Griffin again.
The anti-lynching movement had been going on for some time before the recording of Strange Fruit. There were anti-lynching campaigns throughout the United States. Strange Fruit became not just a song of protest, but a kind of elegiac song, a song of mourning. And it was a song that also sparked a kind of activism for Black communities.
Perhaps seeing the incredibly brave performances of Billie Holiday, walking onto a stage every night despite powerful people after her, many musicians have since covered the song. The most famous might be Nina Simone in 1965, a singer who expanded on Billie's legacy with songs like Mississippi Goddamn.
Picket line, school boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. My country is full of lies. We are all gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust nobody anymore. They keep on saying go slow. That's just the trouble.
So.
Desegregation.
So.
Mass participation.
So.
Unification.
So.
Do things gradually.
So.
We'll bring more tragedy.
So.
And that's one of the lasting legacies of Strange Fruit, inspiring others to tell terrible truths. Because the truth is still shocking. Those YouTubers seeing Strange Fruit for the first time are utterly shocked to hear a truth teller like Billie. And that's before they realize how long ago she did it. Billie Holiday was hesitant to take that weight on. She knew it would be a weight, and though she couldn't have known the particulars of what the powers that be might do, she knew something awful could come her way. But over the years, she gained a defiance when she sang the song. In that performance that we listened to at the beginning of the episode from 1956, Billie is nearly two decades into government persecution, deep into a debilitating addiction, and surviving abuse from multiple corners of her life. She's singing at a time that racism is killing more than ever. The audio actually came from a video performance, and you can see that in the link in the show notes. And in that video, you can see all that weight, all that heaviness on her face and her body. But you can also see the determination, the fuck you to everyone that tried to tell her to stop. That's art as resistance. So what can we learn from this? We go with our gut. The things that scare us, the things that others tell us not to do, might be the things that define us and impact the world. We tell the truth, the terrible, ugly truths of this world. And we commit to making art as resistance for the long term, for a better world. The Art of Resistance is a podcast for the artists, the lovers of art, and people who want to resist but don't know how. These stories are designed to help us find inspiration from the past and empower us all to find some hope for today and tomorrow. I'm Amy Lee Lillard, and I wrote, narrated, and produced this show. And there's so much more to this story. At artofresistance.space, you'll find sources, images, and videos for this episode and all the others. Here's an easy way to learn more about Art as Resistance. Sign up for the free newsletter at artofresistance.space and get stories and tips every week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.